And welcome to this week's edition of An Organic Conversation, a show about food, ecology, stories from the land, relationships, and life itself. We're your hosts, Helge Hellberg,
Mark Mulcahy,
and Sitarani Palomar.
And this is the time of the holidays, still leaning into the new year.
Yes,
our first
happy
show
new year.
Of the new year, Mark. Finishing 2012 and starting 2013.
We have some really exciting things to look forward to for 2013.
Yes, great year last year. Fantastic guests from amazing authors, from volunteering to pumpkin pie. We did it all. And yes, great shows to look forward to. And we couldn't do this work without our wonderful associate producer, Kristen Ponger. So a big shout out at this time
yes.
of the beginning of the year.
I know we've had some incredible guests, and we would not be where we are without the woman behind the show who brings all of these incredible voices to our conversation. So thank you, Kristen.
Yes, Kristen Ponger. And we pongered this for a long time, but it's absolutely needs to be said. And also Robert Costa as our devoted and dedicated engineer, making it sure that we sound nice, much nicer than we actually sound.
Yeah, literally, that's why we're on the airwaves, is
that's
because
right.
of Mr. Costa.
Robert Costa, the one and only. So we're starting off the new year with the last week of the best off.
Yeah, and whose favorite is it this week?
It's mine.
It's Helga's.
Yes, for the holidays and always into the new year, we feature three of the best shows of the last year as kind of a recap and getting ready for the 2013 theme season and baseball season two. Mark is already smiling.
Mm-hmm.
And this week, it was my pick. We had 3 weeks ago baking, that was Mark's pick. Last week we had Sita with economic empowerment, and this week it's my pick, and it's the oceans. We had a wonderful, wonderful, very moving show with Pierre-Yves Cousteau, and he described in the original air date, May 19th of last year, him coming up on a dive and seeing 6 feet of plastic floating in the ocean. And I'm all about soil. I consider myself a soil keeper, and yet the interface between our land use and our practices on the land and our relationship to soil and food, how much that affects the ocean and vice versa, was just so moving. An incredible show. Pierre-Yves Cousteau, the son of Jacques Cousteau, who kind of throughout my childhood really educated me on the oceans with amazing films that are now just, you know, history pieces that are of incredible value. That was the show I picked. So happy holidays and a wonderful,
and happy new year.
Wonderful new year of 2013. We're looking forward to delivering the finest broadcasts available in the world of sustainability. You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And I'm Sitarani Palomar.
And yes, we'll see you next week with our first new wonderful episode. But today, enjoy the rerun of the original air date, May 19th, Pierre-Yves Cousteau with Oceans.
Diving into a world of silence.
Well, it's not far down to paradise. At least it's not for me. And if the wind is right, you can sail away and find tranquility. Oh, the canvas can do miracles. Just you wait and see, believe me. It's not far to Never Never Land, a reason to pretend. And if the wind is right, you can find the joy of innocence again.
And we are back here to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And I'm Sitarani Palomar.
1942 changed the way we had been exploring the oceans. Up until then, we were able to dive by using a full body suit with a huge metal helmet on top, all connected to a boat on the surface that would pump oxygen through long hoses into the helmet. In 1942, after a few years of development and refinement, Jacques Cousteau introduced the world the aqua lung, the individual oxygen tank sitting on the back of a diver. The system allowed free movement, and the diver was only restricted in his or her underwater exploration by the amount of air in the tank. For the past 70 years, the name Cousteau has been synonymous with diving and the breathtaking life under the surface of the oceans, really bringing us this fascinating world into our classrooms and living rooms for 7 decades. The passion and love for the water was tangible whenever I would watch a film by Jacques Cousteau, and his incredible work has been continued by his son, who is as dedicated and inspired by the underwater world that is so captivating and yet that we know so little about. Oceans, diving into the world of silence today in an organic conversation. And in this hour, we will explore the relationship between land and water, our land practices, and how they affect the oceans. And with us in this hour is Jacques Cousteau's son, Pierre-Yves Cousteau, calling from Paris, France. And Pierre, are you with us?
Yes, good evening. How are you?
Good evening. We are great.
Good evening, because there's a 9-hour difference.
Yes. Yes. Thanks for
welcome to the show.
Thanks for the time to spend with us.
For
2 generations now, really, the name Cousteau has been synonymous for the world of the oceans. Can you tell us about your experience growing up on and in the water? When did this work really become your passion too?
Well, my father threw me in the water, so to speak. I was 9 years old, and I started diving then. And I was fortunate enough to follow him on 2 expeditions since then. Most of his exploration days were already behind him, the time on the Calypso and the expeditions at that point. And he was mostly writing a lot and doing a lot of poetry and philosophy.
Yes.
So it was really interesting growing up with him, and he was a wonderful, marvelous person, very wise and very kind. And I took a different path. I went into the space sector, so I was going into astrobiology, which is searching for life in space and understanding the origins of life on our own planet. And I was working at the European Space Agency and taking a vacation to actually get certified in diving, because I'd been diving all over the place, and people would be like, "Oh, your name is Cousteau. You don't need this certification. Please go ahead and dive." And I decided one day I actually probably should get a certification. So I went out and got a dive master, and I just kept going and became an instructor. And then I came to the point where I was like, "Wait a minute! I love diving. My name is Cousteau. I love the ocean. I should really do something about it." And so I decided to dedicate my life and my work to creating a nonprofit organization called Cousteau Divers for Marine Conservation.
And so the environments that you're describing, space and water, it's really almost comparable in the world of how much we know them. We understand so little the depth of the oceans and all the life forms and all the interactions. Even though it has fascinated humans for 100+ years, if not much longer. And same with space. It's one of those, still fairly unknown frontiers. When we look
Absolutely.
At what we've discovered in the 60s to today, that, that progress is, there's much, much more to understand.
Yes.
So, Pierre,
there's many similarities, weightlessness being one of them, between being underwater and being in space. And I think both space and the ocean have a tendency of making, the human being dream, and kind of pushing our imagination to its extremes and making us develop faster. So when we
Beautiful.
Gaze at the stars, we tend to dream about the stars. When we gaze out into the ocean, we kind of have the same feeling. So I think there's a lot in common between the two.
And Pierre, is it the same feeling of weightlessness? Have you experienced both? In space?
I have not, actually. I was scheduled to fly on a parabolic flight when I was during my studies, but I didn't, actually. So I can't tell you if it's the same. Probably it's quite different, because the viscosity of the air is very different from that of water.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Something I'm sure you're still looking forward to doing, though. You'll have...
Tell us at another show, yes. In the future.
Actually, to be perfectly honest, I hope one day I'll be diving in an ocean on another planet.
Oh, there you go. Wow, yeah.
Limitless imagination and making it
How
possible.
Cool would that be?
That would be incredible. So, Pierre, tell us about what aspects of the ocean you are focusing on. You mentioned Cousteau Divers. What is that initiative, and what kind of projects are you involved in?
So, Cousteau Divers is it's a nonprofit organization that I created based on the idea that there's tens and dozens of millions of recreational divers out there, people who just scuba dive because they love it. And these people are the only ones, and you were saying, as you were saying earlier, who see beneath the surface. When you look out at the ocean, it could be doing great, could be dying, and you wouldn't know the difference because you can't see beneath the surface. But these divers, millions of divers, all day, every day, or as often as they can, probably, go diving and actually witness what's going on. So the idea behind this project is to get them to collect data, to collect information, to collect images, much in the same way my father did, but taking it really down to anybody who dives, who snorkels, or spends any time looking beneath the surface, to help collect this information to get us kind of a near real-time diagnostic of the health of the oceans, with, in time, the ability to react to any kind of possible environmental alert that that diagnostic would generate.
So what does the diagnostic look like? Do they have like a 20-point sheet that they, after the dive, recount on what they saw, water visibility, all that? What guide us through that?
Absolutely. There's several ways of doing it. One of them is taking with you underwater a slate and actually spending time counting different species of fish or invertebrates, and recording the kind of biological cover that you have on the different substrates. Another way of doing it is a lot simpler. It's as a biological debriefing. So when people are done with their dive, they come out and their dive master perhaps collects the information from their dive. So what did you see? What did you see? What did you see? And everyone's going to have seen different things. But the fact that they saw something is still valuable information.
Wonderful. And how many people are members of that, of Cousteau Divers, at this point?
Well, since the nonprofit's been up and online, so a little bit over a year now, we have about 2,500 registered users who have uploaded about 4,000 images on our website.
Wow, incredible.
So you can go ahead and have a look at the website and browse it, and it's pretty much like saying, oh, what does it look like under the surface of the ocean here? And you click, and then you can see the images that people have been reporting.
And that's CousteauDivers.org.
And what's the ultimate goal of the data collection and the pictures, besides us being able to see different places in the ocean that we may never see? Is there another goal behind Cousteau Divers?
Absolutely. And you raise a very important point about, you know, awareness of the environment, which I think is very different from actually taking action. And this is where Cousteau Divers really stresses the importance of taking action, because when we collect this information, the goal is to have a database that can automatically generate alerts in case of environmental degradation. And in that case, we can react to those alerts, much like an immune system in the human body, for instance, and go to that place and with scientists and determine what's the resource, what's being lost, what's causing the loss, and trying to come up with a comprehensive solution, including the lobbying behind it to push it forward within the community of the people that are concerned by the problem, to get to get things to go better locally.
Yes, the ocean is really one of those indicator environments, which, I mean, where do you draw the line, right? Everything is an indicator, but people do talk about indicator species that it's like the canary in the coal mine, if we observe abnormal behavior or death or a certain impact on certain species, it has a ripple effect into many other life forms.
Absolutely. Bioindicators are very important, and often they tend to be... some bioindicators, at least, are the commercial fishes. So if you can see that there's a drastic decline in the commercial fisheries, then you can also look at the numbers of the fishermen who are collecting these organisms. So you can see that they're seeing a decrease in their catch, because, well, the stocks of fish are collapsing everywhere in the world, to be honest.
Yes, we want to talk about that in the second part. With us is Pierre Yves Cousteau, the son of Jacques Cousteau, and in this hour we are exploring the world under the surface, talking about ocean health and our relationship on land practices with the oceans of this world. And Pierre, yes, we want to dive into that right after a quick break that we are taking to hear more about our land practices and what you see affects the oceans the most right now. I'm Helge Hellberg.
I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And I'm Sitarani Palomar.
You're listening to An Organic Conversation, and we'll be right back after the break.
I'm old at sea, where no
forgot my roots. If only for a day, just me and my thoughts, sailing far away, like a warm drink it seeps into.
Are you a chef, have a catering business, or planning a party, or simply just love organic produce? If you're in the San Francisco Bay Area, walk right in to Earl's Organic Produce. Anyone can buy directly from us at wholesale prices. You don't have to be a natural food store to enjoy the freshest and most delicious organic produce. We are located on the San Francisco Produce Market at 2101 Gerald Avenue. We look forward to seeing you.
Walk-in hours are Monday through Friday throughout the night from 10 p.m. to 10 a.m. Minimum purchase is one box or flat, cash or checks only. For more information, visit earlsorganic.com.
Frey Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family-owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Frey never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Frey organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. Frey Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines without added sulfites. Available at grocery stores and online at freywine.com. That's FREYWINE.com.
Are you interested in making healthy food your profession? Bowman College is a leader in the field of holistic nutrition and culinary arts. Their professional training programs prepare individuals for successful careers as nutrition consultants and natural chefs. Study at one of four locations in California and Colorado, or learn from home in a self-paced mentor distance learning program. Find out more about their classes on holistic nutrition and culinary arts at BowmanCollege.org. That's B-A-U-M-A-N College.org.
At Testa Epicure Skilled, we provide tea and coffee from the regions of the world known to produce the finest of their kind. Always certified organic and fair trade, we stand for exceptional taste and highest quality. Every cup of our tea and coffee is connected to the soil and the people working the land. We have searched the world for the best ingredients and invite you to enjoy Desta tea and coffee. Find Desta at your natural food store or online at Desta.com. That is D-E-S-T-A.com.
And we are back here to an organic conversation. I'm Helga Helberg.
I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And I'm Sita Rani Palomar.
The topic of today's show is oceans diving into the world of silence. And with us from Paris, France, is Pierre-Yves Cousteau, the son of Jacques Cousteau and the founder and president of Cousteau Divers. Pierre, you mentioned before the break that Cousteau Divers is really a monitoring system of hobby divers around the world, keeping track of environmental impacts and the status of the ocean. And at that point, I do want to give a shout out to Donald and Margaret Hoynatsky, who live in Kona, Hawaii, and are dedicated divers, and also our Chef Sita's parents. What's your vision with this in 10, 15 years? How can the system respond or monitor or track data to really have a global constant watch view on this, on the health of the ocean? Is that the idea? Using Facebook for divers focused on the ocean, kind of that kind of network?
Absolutely. The goal is to harness the power of, social media and grassrooting environmental problems to get communities, local communities, to act up on their environmental problems, the environmental problems that are going to affect them and their children in the future. To give you an example of our actions, once we have the monitoring system in place, a couple of weeks ago I was in Santorini in Greece, where we've been working very, very much with the locals to establish a marine protected area. Mm. Because marine protected areas are wonderful tools to recover the health of the oceans, and developing more and more of these areas is really, really very good for the ocean.
And that means marine protected area, there's no fishing allowed. Is there some boating or some restricted diving allowed?
That's right. Well, there's every, it's a very wide spectrum of definitions for marine protected area.
Yes.
What I mean when I say that is no fishing. So these are areas that you close from fishing, where you accept recreational activities, mm-hmm. of course, regulated. But you take out the fishing element. And actually, this has been tested, you know, in many places around the world. And in successful marine protected areas, it can be a real economic driver. And the fishermen can benefit from it as well, interestingly enough.
And how can the fishermen benefit from that?
Well, the fishermen actually benefit from it in the same way that you benefit from agriculture. So by the fact that you're protecting one area and leaving it to recover, within 5 or 10 years, the area will have recovered quite well. We've seen that in most situations. And you can then fish around the area. So you're fishing the excess from the area, if you will. So the fish are multiplying inside the marine protected area, and when they exit the marine protected area because there's too much population inside the area, then the fishermen have a constant catch and a reliable one. So it's much like farming the ocean, really.
Hopefully with catch limits, but you're basically saying those marine protected areas are the nursing home for all the species to recover and find strength again, that with catch limits actually could be provide a certain source of food and income for the fishermen.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, not to mention the benefits from the tourism industry.
Because, sure.
For example, in Spain, there's one marine protected area called the Medes Islands. It's a very small group of three islands, but they generate 10 million euros. So that's maybe $12 or $13 million a year in diving. There's 60,000 divers who come dive because they know that that's where the best fish are, where the biggest fish are, where they're going to see the most life. So that's where people go diving.
You're listening to an organic conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And I'm Sita Rani Palomar.
And with us on the phone is Pierre-Yves Cousteau, calling in from Paris, France. The founder and president of Cousteau Divers, and that website is cousteaudivers.org. If you're a diver or know somebody, please point him to that site and sign up, because we need more people in the water monitoring the very status of the ocean health.
So, Pierre, you were talking about collecting data and pictures and setting aside areas to help them recover. So what is the ocean telling us? You know, what can you tell us about the health of the ocean right now?
Well, I'm only 29, so I haven't dived every water on the globe yet. But there's several things I'd like to tell you about the connection between our land and the ocean. You know, we tend to see the ocean as a vast, infinite area that we can't see underneath the surface of. But in fact, the ocean is part of our everyday life, no matter where we live. The ocean produces more than half of the oxygen that you're breathing right now with the microorganisms in the surface layer. And it provides food and for millions of people throughout the world and lifestyles. And we rarely recognize just how connected our life is to the ocean and how our land is connected to the ocean. Through the cycle of water, first of, because all the water in the ocean is not stagnant. It's constantly evaporating and then coming down again as rain. And we ourselves are made mostly of water. We are, so to speak, drops of water taken from the ocean. And the ocean goes through us all the time as we drink and as we go to the bathroom. And the ocean is really an integral part of our life on land, and it's important that we realize that, because we need to protect it as a life support system.
And where's the ocean at this moment from your perspective, knowing you were 9 when you were thrown in, you know the legacy of your dad that you're continuing? Yeah. Where are we at?
Well, what's really interesting today is to look at my father's footage that's been taken for the past 60 years and over the 100 different locations, and to go back and to film the same places and to see the before and after. Mm. And in most cases, it's a bit disgusting, because there's just nothing left in most of these places. And the ocean is in really a pretty bad condition. We've always considered it infinite, and that our species could not have an impact on it. But in fact, we're really, really having a deep impact, and we're modifying it profoundly, not only through ocean acidification as a consequence of fossil fuel burning, but also through overfishing.
You mean acid rain, right? Acid rain, the first part, and then overfishing. That's the two.
No, the acidification of the ocean, because of, as we release more and more CO2 into the atmosphere, that CO2 dissolves into the ocean.
Yes.
And it has chemical reactions that acidify the ocean, that make it acid, literally acid. And it's, we can see that data shows that the ocean is growing more and more acid and warmer also.
And what does the acidity do? Does it break down the coral reefs, and or what's the impact of acidity?
It'll affect any organism that has an external skeleton. So if you take a shrimp, for instance, a lobster, if you take coral, any organism that calcifies on the exterior, on the outside, is affected by this and is potentially jeopardized by the acidification.
It's an interesting analogy, too, when you look at our bodies, because our pH balance wants to be right at 7.4. And if we over-acidify, that's when we start to see diseases happen in the human body. So, of course, the same thing is true for the ocean.
So,
CO2
emissions acidifying the ocean, and then you mentioned overfishing. Are those two the largest impacts that you see that we need to address immediately?
Yes, absolutely. Overfishing is very disturbing because scientists are saying that by 2040 there could be just simply no more fish, a collapse of all the global fisheries.
2040? Wow, that's
so
that's soon.
Yeah, that's right around the corner, yeah. Yeah, it's scary. But hopefully we can create sufficient amount of these marine protected areas so that they can be kind of nurseries to recolonize and repopulate the oceans.
Yes, and we want to talk about solutions and visions for the future with you in the second half of the hour. We are talking with Pierre-Yves Cousteau, the founder and president of Cousteau Divers, the son of Jacques Cousteau, who since the 50s brought us the world of the oceans into the classrooms and the living rooms that we all grew up with. Pierre now continuing that legacy of the Cousteau family. Pierre, stay with us. You're joining us today from Paris, France. Thanks again for making the time. You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And I'm Sita Rani Palomar.
And Mark, it's time for that weekly produce update, changing completely the story from, and not really actually, because everything we do on land affects the ocean.
Absolutely.
As we just learned and we'll hear more about. But this is the weekly update of the world of produce, our very own Mark Mulcahy with what's in season.
Well, today we're talking about a springtime crop that only about 5% of this crop is sold fresh, and yet people love it. And so on the line with us today is the voice of the market, Earl Herrick from Earl's Organic Produce. Earl, you have any idea what we're talking about?
I think we're talking about some peas.
Aha.
And I think maybe we even narrow it down to sugar snap peas.
Good guess.
You know, how do you always know the answer?
You know, you and I have been doing this so long, Mark, I think we dream about it.
This is true.
Am I awake or am I asleep?
And you guys talk about it before the show, so maybe that has something to do with it, too. How are you doing, Earl?
Doing fantastic. It's great great to see the winter, the weather change and really starting to enjoy this great weather.
Yes, we are heading into the summer now after Mother's Day. Wonderful. Tell us about sugar snaps. How's the season coming?
Well, I also wanted to just touch base real quickly that there are other peas out there, and that's a snow pea and an English pea. Mm-hmm. And they're all different. A snow pea is going to be flapped and eat the whole thing. An English pea are those ones that you peel the pod off and enjoy mm-hmm. the peas inside.
Yes.
Now, the sugar snap, you get to enjoy the whole pea, and it's a big, and the best ones are big and fat, and they're incredibly sweet. And this is the perfect time of year because it really is a fairly short window, especially in most of the United States. California produces the most, but it's grown mostly. It's available on both coasts, and interestingly enough, up the Mississippi Valley.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Mm-hmm. Is it a good year for sugar snaps?
Repeat right? that, Helga?
Yeah. Is it a good year for sugar snaps?
Well, it's a great year. And, you know, what's so great about it is that depending on where you are, you can grow it at certain times because it enjoys the mild weather. Mm-hmm. So out in California, where most of them are grown, you can plant them in the fall, and they winter over, and then you can have them by March. And then you can put some more in the ground in January, February, and enjoy them in April and May.
Mm,
so it's almost a a year-round crop if you're in a the wonderful coastal area.
And it kind of starts off the gardening season too. I always feel like peas is one of those things. It's the first real summer vegetable that comes in that you can eat right out of your garden, or of course, finding it at the store. Are there different varieties?
Well, there's many, many different varieties of sugar snaps. You know, just even like blueberries, there's all these crazy, interesting names. And what you need to do is understand the where you are in your altitude and really the climate itself to pick the right one. For many of the guys, what's so great about it is that when I talk to growers and my own experience in eating them, and you probably know this too, Mark, and is that they're best eaten within 3 to 4 days after harvest.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, some of the names out there, there's Sugar Ann and Sugar Bon and those are just a couple of the names. There's many, many varieties of sugar snap peas, as there are with the other varieties of peas. Well, Earl, it's a good season. You have one more thing you want to throw in there?
Yeah, I wanted to know that peas are one of those things that you know you're eating local. Because since you got to eat them and enjoy them within 3 to 4 days, you're not shipping them a long way. So you can feel really good about eating local when you're eating this kind of stuff. And also, they're treated in such a they're coming out of a mild area, so they don't require a whole lot. But some people use a hydrocooling, which is really just a cold shower, which gets the heat out of the product and gets the cold and keeps it fresh.
Oh, suspends it in time a little bit.
Exactly.
Yeah. Nice.
It takes the temperature out of the pea if it was warm at all, and so that just helps to prefer
the temperature out of the pea. Yes.
it gives it an attitude check right there.
That's right. Anytime you get a cold shower, it gives you an attitude check.
No,
that's
kidding.
For sure.
So I did want to mention last thing in parting. There's a couple challenges that sugar snaps have, and that's the weather, like everything. Mm-hmm. But it's specifically the wind, because these are grown in bushes, and when the wind in the spring whips up, the leaves on the bushes can scar the pod, and too much scarring not only makes it unattractive, but it actually creates a little bit of starch there too, which, you know, is not particularly enjoyable.
Yeah, you want them to be sweet.
No,
yeah,
we know where that's from.
Cool.
That's great.
So,
yeah, it's that wind.
Yeah. Well, so that wouldn't be a win-win situation. Thanks, Earl, for joining us today. As always, it's a pleasure. Enjoy your week and your weekend, and we'll look forward to talking to you next week.
Always good talking to you.
Thanks, Earl. Take care.
So as Earl was mentioning, you could tell his excitement around these peas. Sugar snap peas are actually known as the kings of the edible pod peas. And so even though snows might be a little bit more familiar to people, the reason that is because snow peas have been in the market longer. Actually, snap peas were developed in the 17th century, but they didn't come to the United States to be commercially available until 1970. And so, you know, that's partway into my life where I'd never even know they existed. And I wouldn't even work in produce then. So they're a cross between a garden pea, like a shelling pea, like Earl was talking about, and snow peas. So that way, that's why you can eat the pod, because you can eat the whole flat pod of a snow pea. When you're looking for them, whether at the farmer's market or at your store, look for bright green firm pods that have a slightly bit of velvety feel to them. And they need to snap. If they're spongy or rubbery at all, then leave them be. That means they're starting to age. And when you get them home, what you want to do is you want to put them in a tightly sealed plastic bag, and they'll store for just a few days, as Earl was saying, like 2 to 3, maybe 2 to 4 days. But you want to eat them very fresh. And then to prepare them, once you've washed them in some cool water, you want to snap off the top and then pull the fibrous string down along the edge to take that out, because it is pretty fibrous and you don't really want to be eating it. And lastly, a cooking tip, not to jump on Sita's area of expertise here, but you don't want to cook them for very long. You want to make sure only 2 to 3 minutes. If you're throwing them in a saute, throw them in late. If you're going to simmer them in some broth or something, or steam them really, really quick, because if you overcook them, not only do they lose their color, that beautiful bright green color, but they also start losing their flavor. And then, you know, That's why you're eating them. You want that sweetness for sure. So that's what's in season. And back to you.
Thank you, Mark, for that weekly update of what's going on in the world of produce. And yes, this is an organic conversation, and we do talk about organic agriculture and organic food, but it's really a conversation that we feel must be had every week, as we are showing the ecology of things, the relationship between our practices and the relationship between organic sugar snap peas and the oceans of this world. Our topic today is oceans, diving into the world of silence. With us from Paris, France, calling in, still with us is Pierre-Yves Cousteau, the founder and president of Cousteau Divers. And Pierre, before the break, we talked about exactly that, the status and health of the oceans and how our land practices or our practices as human beings in our relationship to the oceans affect the health and where we are, what the status is. And overfishing was mentioned as, of course, a huge impact, one of the sources of big impact. Also, CO2 emissions. What other examples do you see when you're under the surface of human doings that end up in the ocean? For example, when we talk about organic agriculture, is over-fertilization with synthetic pesticides in non-organic agriculture, is that something that is evident? Do you see that?
Yes, absolutely. Use of fertilizers and an intensive agriculture and is causing runoff in the rivers, which then end up in the ocean, of course. But there's one thing that particularly has shocked me from what's going on in the ground, and that affects the ocean. And that was when I was diving inside a marine protected area, one of the most beautiful ones I've been to. It's inside the Mediterranean Sea, Cabrera. And I was just finishing a dive there, and I was coming up from this fantastic dive. And as I came up, the top 3 meters, so maybe 10 feet, of seawater was just a plastic soup. It was literally a soup of small chunks of plastic. And it was really horrible to see this inside a marine protected area. But of course, the ocean knows no limits, much as the atmosphere. And what happens somewhere is carried away throughout the entire system. Today there's a major problem of garbage, of trash, mostly plastic, throwaway plastic. There are 5 continents of plastic inside the oceans that are huge, and they're gyres. They're trapped inside these revolving currents, and they show just how insane our throwaway societies are. Just using plastic and throwing it away, using plastic and throwing it away. When you think of the resources it takes not only to build those objects that are in plastic, but then the fact that they don't degrade when they're in the ocean or very slowly, and that they're, you know, killing marine life and just trashing our ocean, really, that's what it is.
So do you feel there's enough public awareness, and what can be done? What is it seems to come up from a dive into a 10-foot plastic, kind of somewhat dissolved, but still continuous plastic cover. What can be done? Ocean Cousteau Divers will monitor this now, but what must happen in terms of policies to recognize this?
Well, I think the only way really to limit this is to reduce how much plastic we use, how much throwaway plastic we use in our everyday life. If you try to spend one day refusing systematically any throwaway plastic, plastic bottles, plastic cups, plastic cutlery, you'll find it's very difficult. It's really hard to spend a day without using any throwaway plastic. I've tried a few times, and it's really tough because our societies are built that way, and it's such an integral part of our everyday lives. But we need to raise awareness of this problem and to get people to realize, wait a minute, I don't need this plastic bag. I don't need this plastic cup. Or I'll wash this cutlery. I don't need to get plastic stuff I can throw away, because that all ends up in the ocean.
Yeah, ultimately, everything we do, right? Everything we do will end up in the atmosphere or in the ocean. What's your vision for the future? Knowing this now, seeing the footage 40 years old that your dad put together, and going to the same places to see what has changed, how environments have changed, now setting up this international network of divers. And during the break, we talked about you don't have to be a scuba diver, actually, to be part of Cousteau Divers. First of all, anyone can donate and support your great work. You don't even have to like the water in that sense. Well, maybe that's a requisite. But
probably a prerequisite, yeah.
Yes, but you don't have to be a scuba diver. You said there are several levels from, you know, you could just snorkel or you could just actually love to walk at the beach and monitor certain, you know, environmental impacts. There are different tiers that you mentioned.
Absolutely. And, you know, having set this up only 2 years ago and working with it every day now to raise this global community of people who want to heal the ocean and to study it, I've come to the conclusion that, you know, if you see something in your everyday life, in your surroundings, that you don't like, that you're not happy with, that you think is wrong, well, you better stand up for it and create, you know, your own movement to get people to follow you and to do something about it, because no one else is going to. No one else is going to do that if you don't do it, if you feel that something's wrong. So it's going to be different for each person. Some people are going to be, you know, I love dolphins. I want to protect dolphins. And then maybe they'll turn their life in that direction. Other people, it's going to be something else. So it's really very personal, but it's important that I think that as many people as possible actually do it.
Yes, there's this great story of, I think it was seashells that were washed onto the shore, still living living animals, and somebody threw a couple back, and somebody else said, why would you do that? It doesn't make any difference. And he said, well, it made a difference to those two. So yes, we can have an impact, however great, but if we all do it, then that effect will be great. Pierre, we want to hear from you a beautiful moment of diving that really kind of, you know, changed your life or touched you very, very deeply. We'll take another super quick break to honor our underwriters who make this show possible. But we'll be right back with you in a second. With us again, okay. Pierre-Yves Cousteau, the founder and president of Cousteau Divers, and that's CousteauDivers.org. Joining us today from Paris, France, I'm Helge Hellberg.
I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And I'm Sita Rani Palomar.
And of course, you're listening to An Organic Conversation. We'll be right back.
To sail on a dream, on a crystal clear ocean, to ride on the crest of a wild raging storm, to work in the service of life and the living, in search of the answers to questions unknown. To be part of the movement, part of the growing, part of beginning to understand.
At Testa Epicure Skilled, we provide tea and coffee from the regions of the world known to produce the finest of their kind. Always certified organic and fair trade, we stand for exceptional taste and highest quality. Every cup of our tea and coffee is connected to the soil and the people working the land. We have searched the world for the best ingredient and invite you to enjoy Testa tea and coffee. Find Desta at your natural food store or online at Desta.com. That is DESTA.com.
Frey Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Frey never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Frey organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. Frey Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines without added sulfites. Available at grocery stores and online at freywine.com. That's FreyWine.com.
Produce is ever-changing, seasons coming and going. At Earls Organic, we have been sourcing solely organic produce for over 20 years. Since 1988, Earls Organic Produce has been establishing strong relationships with growers and developing a deep understanding of the seasons, so you can offer the most delicious organic produce to your customers, staff, and clients year-round. For organic produce, visit Earls Organic Produce at earlsorganic.com. That's earlsorganic.com.
Are you interested in making healthy food your profession? Bowman College is a leader in the field of holistic nutrition and culinary arts. Their professional training programs prepare individuals for successful careers as nutrition consultants and natural chefs. Study at one of four locations in California and Colorado, or learn from home in a self-paced mentor distance learning program. Find out more about their classes on holistic nutrition and culinary arts at BaumanCollege.org. That's B-A-U-M-A-N College.org.
And we are back here to an organic conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And I'm Sita Rani Palomar.
Here is our very own chef Sita Rani Palomar, with her holistic bite.
The Holistic Bite is my weekly update on all things that contribute to holistic wellness and beauty, including sustainable fashion and skincare and food and nutrition. And this week, I dedicated a lot of time this week to cleaning out my closet because I want to lighten up everything, not just my diet, not just my clothes, but also my closet. And I have a friend who really inspires me because he keeps his closet really simple. All he keeps are the things that he absolutely loves. They fit like they were made for him. They continue to match his style and his maturity level, and he's always excited to wear them. And what it did for me was shift my views on what I keep in my closet, because I have dozens and maybe even hundreds of things in my closet that I don't even wear. And I kind of rationalized to myself that I may wear that item, but only once this year. So maybe I should keep it, but it's not something I'm excited to see every day. And on the small chance that I might wear it once, is it really worth occupying the space in my closet? Or is it more important to have it not occupy the space in my closet and occupy the space on somebody's shoulders who may need it? And I know that the things that make me feel the most beautiful, the most capable, the most, you know, contributory and well, are the things that I need, and loving the things that I have without any excess. So while many of the things in people's closets may still be so beautiful and even brand new, maybe you've never worn it before, so you have a hard time justifying donating it, consider that it may be something beautiful, but it may no longer be your something beautiful. So donating something lovely that no longer has a place in your heart means that someone else may find a treasure in it. And don't forget the fun of consigning, too. If you have things that you can sell, right, then you can receive a cash or credit towards purchasing something new at a consignment store. And places like Crossroads Trading Company, Buffalo Exchange, Plato's Closet, they're national brands. There are also independent consignment stores in a lot of the metropolitan cities, and it supports sustainable fashion because you're not just getting rid of things. One person's trash becomes someone else's treasure. And I read a really great article on Crossroads newsletter recently that talked about how to make the most out of your consigning experience that I'll make sure to put on our blog. But put some goodwill into the world and let go of the things that you keep talking yourself into keeping, because you may only wear it one day this year, but someone else may wear it every single week. And in exchange for that gift, what you'll wear every week is a lifted spirit.
Wow.
And that's this week's Holistic Bite.
Wow, cleaning out your closet's kind of like cleaning out your life, huh?
Yeah, everything's on a soul level.
And that was the holistic Bite, brought to you by EcoBella, offering natural and organic skincare and intelligent cosmetics that are made without compromises and are always preservative-free, gluten-free, and cruelty-free. For more information, visit EcoBella.com. That's EcoBella.com. And with us is Pierre-Yves Cousteau, the founder and president of Cousteau Divers and the son of Jacques Cousteau, who throughout the 50s up until the late 80s brought us the world of diving into the classrooms and into the living rooms. I grew up with Jacques Cousteau, and his son now, Pierre-Yves Cousteau, joining us today from Paris, France, continuing that family, that Cousteau legacy of bringing the awareness for the oceans into our daily lives. And Pierre, before the break, that song was John Denver, and it's called Calypso. And of course, he is actually really describing your father's boat. And that song was written for your family.
Yes, it's a wonderful song too.
Yeah, have you met John Denver?
No, I never met John Denver, unfortunately. I've heard the song over and over, though.
You must have. And the captain of the Calypso, we want to send a a wonderful, sweet, heartfelt farewell to Captain Falco. Albert Falco passed away last month at the age of 84. He was the chief diver and captain of the Calypso and spent, what, about 40 years with your father?
That's right. That's right, absolutely. Yeah, he was definitely an emblematic figure of the entire expeditions and the whole adventure that my father started. And it's a great loss for the diving world.
Yes,
he was a wonderful person and an inspiring diver.
So this is the perfect lead-in for this. So there's many of us who've never experienced what it's like to be below the surface. And can you just...
Well, how many of you guys have?
I have.
I have, too.
I've done a little bit of snorkeling, but that's about it. I mean, my whole family, they're all divers, and I haven't gotten into it yet.
Okay, and I want to make a pledge and a commitment here, Pierre, because you have inspired me. I scuba dove in Greece, and you were just describing that, too, actually off the island of Crete, and I panicked in about 100 feet depth. And my diving master was holding me on the ankle because otherwise I would have just shot up to the surface and most likely blown my lungs. So that let me survive, but I never went back other than snorkeling. So I'm committing myself because of my love for the ocean to try again. Yes.
That's great news. And you should never finish on such a horrible experience.
No, I should not.
So that's perfect place to come back to the question. So if a couple of us have been, and I know that feeling, Helga, when I was down there, I was swimming along, and all of a sudden I went, oh, I need to go up and breathe, even though I was breathing.
I know, hyperventilating, yes.
So describe what it's like to be in this amazing place.
Yeah, what do you have, like a life-changing moment that you, I'm sure many, but what is sticking out for you?
You know, I think just generally for people who've never done it before, you jump in the water and you kind of break that surface in a cocoon of bubbles. And then those bubbles go away and all of a sudden you don't know where's up and where's down. And all you're hearing is your own breathing. And suddenly you realize that you're free, that you can go in any direction you want. You're not limited as we are on land to just walking back and forth. You can go in any direction you want. And that feeling of freedom is really one of the things I love most about diving. And of course, it wouldn't be the same if it was in a swimming pool or in the ocean. And when you're doing it in the ocean, you see all these amazing creatures that defy your imagination. You're like, wow, that shape really exists in nature, that color. And it's just a constant amazing experience, constantly amazing.
It sounds so meditative to like just hear the sound of your own breathing and to observe this entire world and kind of unite with it again. Like we all came from the same place and we're all reunited again under the water. Wow, just really life affirming.
That takes me to your previous question about the strong moments I've had underwater. Apart from every single dive, another one that comes to mind is just last year. In the Canary Islands off the coast of Morocco in the Atlantic Ocean. I was snorkeling, actually, not scuba diving this time, with some pilot whales. And they're wonderful animals that looks a little bit like a cross between a dolphin and a whale. And just being in the water with them was such an amazing experience until the moment where one of them actually looked at me. And you can feel that it's not just an eye, you know, rolling around. It's looking at you and it's looking inside you. And that was really a very impressive moment for me. And I realized that there's such a connection right there with an animal that has, you know, nothing to do with my everyday life here on land. So it's constant source of amazing and awe, of amazement and awe.
And you were snorkeling, meaning you had to hold your breath. Whatever, a minute or two. What's your lung capacity? This is just between snorkeling nerds right now, but...
it's not that good, and I think that scuba diving is maybe it's for the lazy breath hold divers who are much more athletic and have to take a lot more care of their lung capacity than scuba divers do.
Yeah, and it's a great start actually. If you're into snorkeling, there's an amazing abundance of life just within the first 10 feet of what you can see. And even if you just circle around the surface, right, you don't even have to really go down. As soon as you have snorkel gear, it's amazing what you can see. Pierre, we're almost out of time, but if people want to support your work, we mentioned your website, cousteaudiverse.org, on any level, even the people who just love to spend time on the beach, whether you snorkel or you scuba dive, as this international monitoring network for the health of the or the status of the oceans. Of course, anyone is encouraged to contribute to your work financially. You do international policy work for these marine areas. What else can people do? What can the media do? What can we do to bring this topic more to the forefront?
I think it's the media has a very important role to play, and my father was very aware of that with his television shows, of course. But the media can really reach out to the people and, you know, let them know that we're living in a form of society that's very destructive to our environment and ultimately to ourselves. But it's not a fatality, and we can imagine new forms of society, new ways of living together that are more harmonious. So we have the technology for that now, and it's just a matter of getting the word out there that, you know, we can do this. We can make things better. We can be extremely efficient at destroying our environment. We've proved that already. Mm-hmm. We can be extremely efficient at making it better, at gardening it the same way that we do when we create marine protected areas.
Yes.
So there is hope, and it's in every person's power to change things, and it's important not to forget that or not to let people make you believe that it's not true.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you for being a pioneer.
Yeah, Pierre-Yves Cousteau joining us from Paris, France, for an entire hour. We'd love to have you on the show. Thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you, my pleasure.
It's like, what is it, midnight now or something in Paris?
It's almost 10.
Yeah, time for lunch, because I know people in France have really funny ways of eating. But yes, thank you for your time, and thanks for all the great work that you're doing. And yeah, we'll have you back, and we'll continue paying attention to your work very much.
Yeah, perhaps we'll see
you
in the ocean
much.
Someday.
Yes, thank you, Pierre. Take
thank
care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And I'm Sitarani Palomar.
And yeah, we dedicated this hour to the oceans, and wow, what an inspiring story.
Helge, you've spent quite a lot of time on the ocean. You've been sailing your entire life. So what's your experience like having a relationship with the ocean and having a relationship with the land? You've kind of dedicated your life in both of those places.
It's fascinating when you spend most of your lifetime on the hard, how we call it, on the land, and you look out into the ocean, you feel you're standing on something higher, and you're looking out into kind of a very, very big lake, a body of water. When you're on the ocean, it's the opposite. You're actually at one point realizing that it's all water. And the ground, the ocean ground, sometimes comes up enough to provide us with so-called land, but it's just the ocean floor peeking through the ocean. Mm-hmm. It's actually, everything is water instead of everything is land, and there happens to be some, you know, some big puddle in front of you. The entire world is ocean, and sometimes the ocean ground breaks through the surface and creates habitable area. But it really changes the moment you spend, you know, more than a few days on a boat and you look from the water onto the mountains. You realize this is just elevated ocean floor. That's all it is.
And mm-hmm. How does that change your appreciation?
Well, then you realize that everything we do, how, first of all, I love sailing because I love land. I love looking at the coastal areas. And it's really a different viewpoint when you look at it from a, you know, half a mile out on a boat. You're just really grateful for life on Earth, whether it's the water or the land, how sacred land is. You know, as much as water is sacred. But yeah, it really changes your perspective on value and how fortunate we are and the varieties that grow in soil. And so, yes, continuing what Pierre Cousteau just talked about, just from a different vantage point of being more a boater than an earther.
A boater than
an earther. Yes. I don't think we have time to get into an organic moment. In fact,
that kind of was
Robert. Yes, that was the organic moment.
Okay, then that was this week's edition of An Organic Conversation. Thanks for listening.
And lovely it was.
Yes, An Organic Conversation is a production of the Organic Media Network. Associate producers Kristen Ponger, studio engineer Robert Costa. Production assistant Lauren Mulcahy. Underwriting production provided by The Ear, the one and only Mark Van Gelder. Thank you all.
If you missed parts of this episode or for any other, visit iTunes or anorganicconversation.com.
We're your hosts, Helge Hellberg,
Mark Mulcahy,
and Sita Rani Palomar.
And we'll be back right here, same place, same time next week. See you then.
Bye. La pluie, la mer.